Blog Talk Radio.
Of love, joy, understanding, wisdom, brotherhood. Here comes a time by Isaac Batone's Generation Redemption. This is now the 150th class of Soul Class, and I just want to give thanks and praise to the Most High, the Almighty Creator of all creation. The last week was a little bit difficult for yours truly, your humble cyberspace. Torah Actor Dunzus, your Goodman. And I didn't even know if we were going to have a show today, because I was going through some excruciating back pain. I have a herniated disc in the lower end of my spinal column, and different methods I tried to apply based on what I was taught by chiropractors and physical therapists who have been truly good friends for me and assisted me. Of course, my wife, Valerie, has helped me. But we came to the first day of the week. This is Sunday. This is now March 5th. I believe, 2012, and therefore we have said to ourselves, listen, you have 150 Psalms in the Book of Psalms by King David, so we have to have something that will give thanks for those wonderful creations that he and others had composed, because there are at least 9 other authors to Psalms. So Soul Class, of course, Soul being an acronym for S-7-O, old, it's the original U, Universal Laws, 7 Noahide Commandments, and I think we've gotten to a point, Blessed Souls, where we'll ask you, as students of the Creator, as all possessors of the divine image, which is something which is your eternal possession. No one can take it from you. No one can give it to you. This is something that was bequeathed to you by the Most High, and you can look that up in Genesis 1:26 and 1:27. But rather, we want to pick up, and hopefully in tonight's show, and this is the In Search of Ancient Torah, Ancient Authentic Torah, installment number 36. We hope to pick up from Genesis chapter 2, verse 8, quote, "And the Lord God planted a garden eastward in Eden, and there he put man who he had formed." Then we want to continue on to Genesis 2:9, chapter 2, verse 9, quote, "And out of the ground made the Lord God to grow every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food, the tree of life also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil." Now there's a certain tension here, blessed souls, which is generated based on what's written in Genesis 2, verse 8, and what's written in Genesis 2:9. And this is not the scenario for politically correct discussions, but rather for us to try to start to deal with the implications of dealing with a tree of life and a tree of knowledge of good and evil. And these verses are rather serving as testimony that the Most High, the Almighty Creator, is looking out at us with loving mercies and discernment to see who is really seeking him in truth. Of course, by each person blessed with his or her divine image. As well, we hope to discuss the influences of Rambam as scientist, philosopher, doctor, and last but not least, Torah scholar. We want to go also into, hopefully, Rabbi Nachman's wisdom will be to be discussed, as well as gleanings from the path of the righteous Gentile and compassion for humanity in the Jewish tradition. Of course, anything else which can occur during a live radio broadcast. And by the way, if you want to participate, try to make the show a little more organic. You can call in at 1-347-838-8669. That's 1-347-838-8669. And joining me live now is older brother friend in blood, soul, and spirit, Dennis Ryan, our teacher, advocate, and student of Moshe, Moses ben Maimon. And I'd like to wish you a good evening, Sir Dennis. How are you tonight?
Okay, Don, yourself? I'm sorry I have to go through this coccyx problem, but that's a bane of the bottom of the spinal for spinal bone for everybody.
Yep. And listen, you know, Rambam, I think he taught in the Guide to Perplexed that one must be wary of the occurrences that occur in one's life, that I cannot blame anyone for this back problem except for myself, because it happened about almost 14 years ago when I was working as an assistant manager in a bookstore called Kahas Publication Society, which is located in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, New York. And I was involved in a series of tedious engagements separating various types of cassette tapes, wonderful series of tapes called It's Good to Know, I think by Rabbi Manus Friedman. And I was stooping over and lifting these boxes and separating the tapes, and I wasn't, instead of, you know, bending down on my knees as I should have because I used to play catcher, a lot of catcher in baseball, I was prostrating my back over the box. And apparently at that time, at the tender age of 36, I hurt my back. And to this day, the pain comes and goes. But I have a regimen of exercises I do, and I do a lot of bicycle riding to strengthen other parts of my body. But last week, it happened. So listen, this is all, I cannot really point the finger at anyone else but myself. And I thank the Creator that I can still ambulate independently. And I hope in the future to do as well. And I'm talking about this, you know, we're not trying to be politically correct or Pollyannish, but we want to share this with other blessed souls listening, Dennis, that preserve your spinal cord and back health, take care of yourself, eat the right foods, do the right exercises, and learn how to lift heavy items or the intermediate weights that are intermediate in terms of the pressure will put on your spinal cord and your back. And do learn from the mistakes of say, like someone like myself, so you don't have to incur this type of, which is at times frightfully painful, back pain. So we're going into the future with the hope that the Most High's blessings will help us get stronger in any way possible. That's the way I look at that situation. Anyway, Dennis, I would like to start the show. Before we get to Rambam, there is a Facebook friend of mine. His name is Exiled, and he is a passionate person, writes passionate poetry, or sometimes he just takes verses from the writings, the Hebrew writings, and he puts them out in English. And I want to just start off the show with this, to sort of like get the ball rolling, and then we'll go on to Rambam with you reading, of course, from Moses Maimonides, physician, scientist, and philosopher.
May I interject something here, Don?
Yes, please.
Oh, okay, because I have a little poem here that I want to read. It's a short one. It's an interesting one, and it's approved by Christianity and Judaism as well. And last week I gave some words of wisdom. I think I said something like, life is boring without God.
Right.
So I went to the internet and put those words in there and said, wait a minute, maybe somebody else said this. So let me see if someone else said this. Because I said, I've read so much and done so many things, maybe I'm just mouthing off what someone else said. Well, it appears it didn't. But while I was going through, I was looking at what it is, I bumped into what is boredom. And boredom, apparently some people associate with circles, humans going in circles. So let me just read this poem rather quickly.
Sure. No, Dennis, take your time. Let the people hear the words clearly. Let's
all right.
A 15-page poem.
This is just a couple of lines.
Okay, please read it.
Okay, generations come and go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The winds blow to the south and turn to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. Now, this comes from Ecclesiastes 1:4-7. And some people say Solomon wrote it. Some people disagree, and this has been going on for time immemorial. But the Babylonian Talmud says, no, Solomon didn't write it. A fellow by the name Ezekiel wrote it. But be that as it may, there's always these things, but we accept what was written from the scriptures, because we believe in it.
Yeah, so I'll be honest with you. I didn't know that there was another opinion, I guess, according to the Talmud, that someone other than King Solomon wrote it. But if that's what it is, I'm not going to challenge that. I guess I'll have to do my own research to learn a little, to get a little more wiser. And speaking of wisdom, I want to pluck out from something that Exiled wrote. And again, this is something he posted on his page and in Facebook. And I'll read it now. By wisdom, the Lord laid the earth's foundations. By understanding, he set the heavens in place. By his knowledge, the watery depths were divided, and the clouds let drop the dew. Do not let wisdom and understanding out of your sight. The beginning of wisdom is this, quote, get wisdom, unquote. The discerning heart seeks knowledge, selah. And selah is a Hebrew word which means with eternal implications. And Exiled had plucked out of Proverbs chapter 3, verse 19, Proverbs chapter 4, verse 7, and Proverbs chapter 15, verse 14. And Proverbs, I have not seen any disagreements on this matter, that Proverbs was in fact written by King Solomon, because at the beginning of Proverbs, he declares that he is the author of this. Now, with that being said, Dennis,
yes.
If you can please now take us to Moses Maimonides, physician, scientist, and philosopher. And this part is a little bit deep, so I'm going to ask you to read it slowly, because it's very, very factual. I guess we're on page 59. Unless you want to take us to another part of the
page
book.
Page 59, it is, Don.
Yes.
This is titled The Art of Cure, a medical text by Maimonides. But what is interesting is the commentary that the people who edit this runs almost parallel to why people complain what Maimonides did in creating the Mishnah Torah. But we'll talk about that later. Let me read.
Yes.
Maimonides, The Art of Cure, otherwise known as the Compendium of Galen. Now, let me interrupt here. Galen was the authority for all of Greek medicine, and he wrote a lot of this down, and a lot of his writings were followed. But he was the primary source, other than at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Has been in existence in Arabic in manuscript form only. There are two distinct manuscripts, one of the Escurial Library in Spain and the other in Paris. The Escurial Castari manuscript was copied in 1413 by Mustafa ibn Fadil Yusuf ibn Sassoon in a North African Arabic script. It is a plain-looking manuscript. There are no decorations, but keywords are in large letters. The 155-page manuscript has numerous minor omissions, since some 24 individual lines throughout the tract, as well as one full page, are missing. The Paris manuscript of 1023 is in Hebrew, Rashi script, and is not dated. The manuscript has decorated captions, and the keywords throughout the manuscript are written in bull script. When compared to the Escurial script, the Paris manuscript is found to be missing at least 15 pages, some extraneous material, bringing this manuscript to 200 pages.
Mm-hmm.
In its format, The Art of Cure deviates from the then-used presentation of medical subjects, and instead of discussing disorders as an origin-oriented system, it deals with classification of diseases, the description of the disease state, wounds, diseases of paired organs, and febrile disorders and tumors. Although Maimonides states in the text that he produced the writings of Galen faithfully, there is no doubt that some of the compendium format allow him to select those observations that he felt were appropriate for time and place. But the criteria for these selections are not stated in his text. Here and there, he illustrates the discussion of disease with clinical examples, which clearly reflect his personal experience as a physician. Maimonides had good knowledge of gross anatomy, which must have been developed through the observation, as he says at one point in his manuscript, and this is a quote, "We ourselves would not know the difference between a round tendon and a nerve if it were not for the art of surgery," end quote. He recognized the difference between pulsating and non-pulsating blood vessels, but obviously had no concept of the circulation of blood, which was discovered hundreds of years after his time. Similarly, he had no knowledge of the psychology as we know it today. The prevailing medical tenets of the time were the Aristotelian principles of the four qualities and the Hippocratic doctrine of four humors. These provided the framework for explanation of natural phenomenon as well as disease phenomenon. According to these schemes, bodily health depended on proper equilibrium between the quantities of hot, cold, dry, and wet, and on the balanced mixing of four humors, the blood, the phlegm, the black bile, melancholy, and the yellow bile, cholera. Disease states were the result of shifts in the equilibrium of the quantity of the qualities, or of the disturbances in the balance of the humors, or of both. Analysis of the state of the qualities and the state of the humors provided the physician with the guidelines for his therapeutic discussions, which were meant to return to the equilibrium and the balance to normal. Like all physicians at his time, Maimonides subscribed, of course, to those concepts in the description of medical conditions and and diseases. He repeatedly refers to the state and the quantities and of the humans in each condition and explains his therapeutic prescriptions in these terms. Thus we read in chapter 5, quote, mm-hmm. Let us assume that the wounded organ has exceeded the temperature state towards dryness of four numbers, and that the complexion of the body exceeded the temperature state towards dryness of three numbers, it is evident. Then that the organ needs a medicine that exceeds the temperature state by one number. All this is known as guess or estimate. So we ended the reading.
Well, what about the mainstays of treatment? Don't you have that in your at the bottom of page 60?
Bottom of page 60. Yeah. Can you read it?
Finish that last paragraph.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. The mainstays of treatment in general were purging and phlebotomy, as well as bathing, diet control, and a variety of medications, most of which were herbals or herbal compounds available in the Mediterranean countries at the time. The choice of the latter was also dependent on the perceived effect on the qualities or on the humans of the sick body.
Right. I just want to, because this is extremely intense material here that to me, I personally have to review it before I make any commentaries on it. I don't think there's anything I can embellish as much as to point out that when he talks about the four humors, we're talking about four different types of fluids in the body, namely blood, phlegm, black bile, which is associated with melancholy, and yellow bile, which is connected with, it's written choler. I'm not exactly sure what the word C-H-O-L-E-R is, but it seems that in the other aspect, on the left side of that table, after we see this listing of these four types of fluids, it seems that the ideal state of blood should be in a hot state, and the phlegm should be cold, and the black bile should be dry, and the yellow bile should be wet. Now, these matters are addressed, I believe, in his prefatory chapters to explaining the ethics of our fathers. But again, this is just to hopefully give to our listening audience, and also to encourage ourselves, Dennis. I mean, I personally have to do a little bit more reading into this. With the limited time I have, it's a little bit difficult, but hopefully in the future I can revisit this particular two pages and try to get a better handle on it. But we do see that Maimonides was willing to acknowledge, first of all, when he talked about the idea of the art of surgery. Now, we do know that back in ancient Egypt, they knew how to do surgery on the brain, because there is definitely evidence of skulls that were discovered where there were some sort of sutures that were in the skull. So people shouldn't associate surgery with, say, like the surgery of, say, 300 years ago, where people were given to like a bottle of whiskey to numb the pain, and then surgery was done. Surgery, quite in fact, could have been more sophisticated going back 2,000-3,000 years ago, but unfortunately, because modern medical teachers have not taken the time to disperse this type of information to the masses, so people would assume that medicine was very primitive in ancient days, going back the Rambam's time, or 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years ago, when actually it could have been very advanced. And today, in the age of specialization, that since the emphasis is not so much on the whole picture, the physicality of the body, the spirituality of the body, the emotional content of the human being, the soul content of the human being, that actually, although of course we have to acknowledge that wonderful things are being done with modern technology in terms to enhance human life, but certain principles have been sort of trampled on. And therefore, where there could have been more development, perhaps it's been hampered because of economic considerations or theological considerations or philosophical considerations? What's your take on this?
Well, my take on this, and it's throughout the book, is that Maimonides, once again, is practicing dynasism. Not dynasism. The opposite of being static. Dynamicism. In other words, he's willing to say, this is the rules that I've been given, and this is the perception. But the practical part comes when he sees what's going on, and now he puts two and two together and says, well, we can be a little bit more dynamic than we were before because we're learning and we're experiencing stuff. So this book that we're reading from is like a tribute to Maimonides because he started putting two and two together long before a lot of other people did.
And I think that, you know, again, I just want to emphasize that in modern medicine, there are doctors that are willing to go in his tradition, meaning to take that dynamic. I mean, you now have to approach, you now have kinetic type of approaches, you know, studying the energy fields within the body and seeing, you know, what were the studying, going deeply into what were the antecedents which led to the sickness of the person or the physical deterioration of the person. So I think that there are many students of Rambam today who are unknowingly his students in the medical field. And I think it's just perhaps if, hopefully, my intent is that if we talk about these things on our humble efforts here on this show, that somehow the word will get to these already students of Rambam who don't realize that they are actually from very, very ancient traditions. And for that matter, we should say also students of Galen. Because Rambam was not ashamed to give credit was credit to do to this ancient doctor by the name of Galen. And I think that's to his credit, and I think that we can learn from it. When someone comes to empower you with wisdom, give them credit for it. Maybe they'll inspire. We will inspire another person to want to go deeper and accomplish what we didn't think was possible to accomplish. But that's the beautiful aspect of the human experience. When you empower another person with knowledge, let them take the ball and run with it until they can score their own personal touchdown. So their team, which is really the whole human family, can benefit from their investigations and accomplishments. Your comments on that, Dennis?
Yeah, well, you mentioned choler, C-H-O-L-E-R. That's a form of irritation.
Okay.
And if you're irritated, it's gonna. They believe that you could tell in your urine as to is it present or not. But it also had a psychological impact that a lot of people weren't disposed at the time to call it as they see it, because it was thought to be one of the causes of anger or bad temper. So here we are associating the human emotional condition to the physical condition. So an association was made a long time ago.
Beautiful. Thank you, Dennis. Now, I mentioned to Dennis before the show, bless his souls, and I'll mention to you now that there is another aspect to Rambam, Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon. In fact, on his tombstone where he's buried, which I had the privilege of going once, it was almost 21 years ago, it is written on his tombstone, from Moses to Moses, there was no one like Moses. And it was not referring to his medical knowledge, which was philosophical knowledge or scientific knowledge, but in terms of his Torah knowledge. And we're going to go now into, hopefully, as we continue this program with Most High's blessings, his introduction to his epic work in terms of his Torah writings called the Mishnah Torah, which literally can be translated as the second to the Torah, which eventually we'll get to this part of the preface where the Rambam talks about why he called this work Mishnah Torah, which means second to Torah. And it's also known as Yad Chazaka, the strong hand. And I'll read a page or so, and then we'll go on to the next section of the show. So it starts out like this, quote, in the name of God, Lord of the world, which is a quote from Genesis 21:33. And then the Rambam quoted, because he was very, his custom was when he would start a chapter in one of his 14 books of Mishneh Torah, he would quote a verse from written scripture as a way of giving over blessing to the writings that he would eventually publish for each chapter of the Mishneh Torah. Then he wrote, "Then I will not be ashamed when I gaze at all your mitzvot, all your commandments." And this is written in Psalms 119:6. So Rambam goes on to say that all of the commandments that were given to Moses, Mount Sinai, were all given together with their explanations. Now, the Rambam here, by saying explanations, is also now going to give a source, which I'll point out to you, friends, in Exodus chapter 24, verse 12. And it says, quote, "And I will give you the tablets of stone, comma, the Torah, quote, and the mitzvah," unquote. Now, the way you might read the mitzvah in the English also could mean the law. So there are three things here discussed. There's the tablets of stone, which the world associates with the epic event at Mount Sinai, almost 3,324 years ago, the Ten Commandments. But then there is the expression, the Torah, which those Ten Commandments were. And then there's what is called the law and the mitzvahs. So the Rambam goes to delineate what is the difference between Torah and mitzvah, or commandment. So he says the following. The Torah refers to the written law, the written scripture. The mitzvah is its explanation. And that God commanded us, meaning the children of Israel, to fulfill the Torah. Now, also we have to understand, in the last book of Mishneh Torah, that Moshe was commanded, instructed by the Most High, to remind the children of Noah, meaning the other peoples outside of the Israelite nation, that they were also given traditions going back to before there was the body, the entity, the nation of Israel. And these were the seven commandments, the Torah that was meant to be given over, the instruction meant to give over to the nations of the world. So again, God commanded us to fulfill the Torah according to the instructions of the law of the mitzvah. So the very fact that you have the word Torah and the word mitzvah is right there, ample proof for us of Israel as part of our tradition that we have to this day, that there was a written instruction. First, there were the Ten Commandments, and there was even more written commandments, which eventually we will go into every one of the 613 when we get, as this show hopefully will further develop. And then the oral explanation, which eventually we'll start to cover in this series as well. And again, but the Rambam wants to emphasize the mitzvah or the law is called the oral Torah. So Rambam continued that Moses, meaning original Moses, the Levite prophet, our teacher, personally transcribed the entire Torah before he died. He gave a Torah scroll to each tribe and placed another scroll in the Ark of the Covenant as a testimonial, as is, the scriptural proof bears fruit to this occurrence, where it says in Deuteronomy chapter 31, verse 26, and states, quote, take this Torah scroll and place it beside the Ark, and it will be there as a testimonial, end of quote. Now, the mitzvah that we talked about before, or the law, as we talked about before, Rambam says, is referring to the explanation of the Torah, meaning all of the written commandments. But Maimonides writes that Moses, the Levite prophet, did not transcribe it. Instead, he commanded it verbally to the elders, and to also his eventual successor, who was Yehoshua, is also known as Yeshua, which is a contracted version of his name, and to the totality of Israel, as is written in Deuteronomy chapter 13, verse 1, be careful to observe everything that I prescribe to you, unquote. For this reason it is called the oral law. Now, hopefully next week's portion of Rambam's introduction to the Mishneh Torah, we'll talk about if it wasn't transcribed by Moshe, how did it continue from generation to generation? So hopefully you'll stay tuned, blessed souls. Next week's section or our presentation of the Rambam's introduction to his work, the Mishneh Torah, by talking about the tradition of the transmission of the oral tradition from Moses down to those people who are considered to be the ones who were involved in putting together what the world calls the Talmudic literature. Dennis, any comments, questions, concerns about this piece of information by Rambam?
There was a place in the guide for the perplexed where the Rambam explained that when he was writing rabbinical or canon type of writings, such as the Mishneh Torah, that he didn't place himself anywhere in the writing. He tried to keep it as close to the original and as simple as he could put it, without interposing his own concept or ideas. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was extraordinary for him to say that, because it put a lot of pressure on him to do that. Even he explains where he couldn't understand some things, or he didn't understand why they were there, he still felt obligated that a holy man in the past had thought it was important enough, and he thought it was a way to honor the holy man to continue that as a tradition. So, yes, and all our religions are really based on the stone tablets, so to speak. The Torah at the time was the five books of Moses. However, that has been expanded on, and other materials over a period of time that were written down as a continuation of the oral history or the explanation of things. So,
right.
Yes, this is, you're now covering a huge amount of ground here that I don't know if people can do it in their lifetimes, Don.
Well, there is actually a teaching in the ethics of our fathers. We're not here to complete the work, but to do what we can. Now, there have been, in every generation, there are certain sages, Dennis, among the Jewish people who are able to take in a certain amount of information, which you and I would consider to be overwhelming, because they're just so studious. I mean, one of them was, we had three particular examples where the former Rosh Yeshiva, head of the, you've heard of Yeshiva University, Rav Yosef, I think it was Yosef Dovber Soloveitchik. He passed on in about 1993. And he also was a very big student of Rambam, and he promoted the idea of Torah and science. And also we had Rav Moshe Feinstein, and he was considered to be this generation that we're a part of, to be he had the great ability to extract out the teachings of the Talmud and apply it to practical Jewish law today with all the complexities of modern life. I mean, how to keep the Shabbat in an era where we have electricity, where in the times of Moses there was no issues of electricity. And then finally the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who was not someone who would rule like Rav Moshe Feinstein, but rather he would give instructions to Jews and children of Noah how to best serve, the Creator. And he was the one who instituted this practice that all peoples, first and foremost, the Jewish people as our inheritance should learn Rambam. But also, one of his students, Rav Moshe Wiener, who wrote this book, Divine Code, openly encourages all the peoples of the world to learn the Mishneh Torah. Now, some parts of the Mishneh Torah are overwhelmingly complex. I will tell you myself, as a Jewish person, I still haven't even begun to scratch the surface in certain types of laws, like how to calculate the new moon, or their laws of purity and impurity, which are boggle the mind. You really have to, you know, like sit back and have a settled mind and not have to go to work. But we're not dealing with that type of reality yet. But there are other parts. The vast majority of the Mishneh Torah is accessible to what I would call a healthy human intellect that is willing to sit back and kick back with a man who was a rationalist, we're talking about Robert Moshe Ben Maimon, and from there can decide what things they would like to learn from, what things they agree with, what things they disagree with. I mean, for myself, I have no problem in agreeing in everything that Rambam says, but I have to admit there are certain things that he covered. And I have to admit, the Guide to Perplexed is one of those books. The Hebrewic writing of it is extremely complex for me, where other areas of Hebrew writings I am much more at home with. But the Lubavitch Rebbe had suggested and advised that Mishneh Torah is something that everyone can really go to town with in terms of spiritually delighting and intellectually getting a satisfaction of knowing. And you mentioned, I think it was you mentioned to me, Dennis, in privately, in public, that the Vatican, the Catholic Church, acknowledged that Rambam was responsible was the man most responsible. And please correct me in my trying to remember what you told me, whether it be in person in personal conversation on the radio, that he is the man most responsible for bringing this concept of the oneness of God among all the peoples of the earth.
If you look in the Catholic Encyclopedia, you will find Maimonides in there. And he's listed under Thomas of Aquinas, who is one of the fathers of the Catholic Church, who publicly acknowledged that the writings of Rambam in explaining God and proving it using Greek logic was the answer that Thomas Aquinas was looking for. And he used Maimonides' concept to further build on the foundation of the Catholic Church.
Beautiful. Dennis, we're about halfway through the show, so we're going to actually play the last installment of what I consider to be some beautiful music, which actually ties in with tonight's show, because we're going to hopefully talk about the Tree of Life tonight. By segueing now to Rabbi Laser Wolf's, this is the 11th song from his album that came out last year called Calming Waters. This is called Tree of Life. It lasts about 4 minutes, and then we'll go back to the show. Then we'll kick back and relax. This is Rabbi Laser Brody's Tree of Life. Enjoy, everyone. Let me just cue it up, and let's give a listen. Whoa, that's not that. That's Isaac Baton. And let me just get out of that. And let's just bear with me, everyone, because this is not WABC 50,000 watts of radio where you have someone working the control board. This is Don Goodman just working off his little laptop. So let's go now to Tree of Life by Rabbi Laser Brody. Enjoy, everyone. Okay, that was Tree of Life, and that, I think, was a fitting segue to hopefully the last part of our show. We'll be talking about this concept, the Tree of Life, in contrast to the Tree of Knowledge of Good and Evil. Now, we're going to pick up with Rabbi Nachman, talking about one of the attributes that a person should internalize in order to try to make an authentic acquisition of Torah, which means to make it an active part of their lifestyle, divine instruction. And this attribute that a person should try to seek and acquire and internalize and hopefully exemplify for other human beings, it's a tough quality to try to integrate into one's life. And we say in Hebrew, u'misarachek min hakovod, meaning to distance oneself from honor. Now, you know, there in society we have something known as a code of honor, honoring one's mother and father. You know, a person should honor one's country. But we're not talking about that type of, you know, we should honor our parents to some degree. We have to hold up to a certain code of honor. We certainly should give thanks and praises for the country or wherever we are. Hopefully that country is going in the right direction. Although America, I heard from a Rabbi Chaim Richman the other day, America is going through a lot of struggles economically and socially. But in his travels across America, Rabbi Richman remarked, there was a remarkable, and I think he was from the East Coast to the West Coast, he is observing a remarkable thirst for the spirit, for the seeking out of the Most High. And people are really asking questions over here because the certainty of the stability that once was pretty predominant in this country, despite the fact that we have to admit there were many social issues with the racism and sexism and all different types of abuse, gender abuse and spouse abuse and child abuse, which unfortunately these problems have not gone away. But those problems were, so to speak, not given the attention they could have been many years ago because people were more caught up with the bounty that was prevalent, say, like 50, 60 years ago, coming out of World War II, when a husband can get out into the streets of the world and find a job and support his family, maybe not like a, you know, like a millionaire or a billionaire, but there was a sense of dignity, and a person could then work in a business, in a corporation, 20, 30, 40 years, and they could expect a pension, live off of that. And we still have some people today that are still benefiting from it who have been affected by those pensions which have collapsed. But with that being said, we're talking about blessing souls that it's not possible, according to Rabbi Nachman, that when a person is seeking to be honored just for the sake of the fact that they are alive as a human being, and they are looking for aggrandizement, to be put upon a pedestal by others, they should know that this type of seeking of honor is actually causing a great danger to themselves. It can cause jealousy on the part of others. It can also, as he calls it, an endangerment to their soul. Because when a person is appraising themselves as someone who is worthy of honor, they are, so to speak, casting upon a judgment on themselves that they are fitting to be the one to be honored, where the truth is all honor is supposed to be given unto God, who is described in chapter 24, verse 7 in Psalms as the king of honor. And the king of honor is the one who judges all judgments, who is to be honored, and unfortunately those who fall short of being honored. Now I'd like to share with you just briefly, blessed souls, a story that involved actually the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rebbe Nachman Mendel Schneerson, 7th Lubavitcher Rebbe, that there was a point after his father-in-law had passed away, he was the 6th Lubavitcher Rebbe, that people were asking him to become the successor. And he really didn't want to do it. I mean, he honestly had made promises that he would run away from the Hasidim who were asking him and from the community that he was a part of and go to, quote-unquote, a place where he would never be found. So one of the Hasidim, acting with a atypical wisdom amongst true Hasidim, true pious people, said to him, to the Rebbe, that he can run away from honor. Or I'm sorry. If I remember correctly, that if a person runs after honor, the honor will run away from them. But if a person runs away from the honor, the honor will run after him. And with that, he hinted to the Rebbe that if he tries to run away from the honor that was due him, which is really, it's an awesome responsibility to have to try to lead thousands and thousands of people, and eventually would lead and guide and advise hundreds of thousands of people, including children of Noah as well, that this honor of wanting to be honored does not come at a cheap price. So therefore, in the acquisition of Torah, one should not seek for the sake of the fact that they are learning or doing the right thing or speaking the right thing. If they're doing it on the condition that they should be honored, they should know that they're going to, unfortunately, I've witnessed this, that when a person is seeking to be honored, in the end, people disrespect that person much more than any temporary honor they might have imagined they might have gotten. Dennis, your thoughts on these matters?
Well, honor is tiptoeing between ego and humility. Wow. Honor is an important part of the integral part of a human. But we must remember that if you go lean too far over one side or the other, you're still tiptoeing between ego and humility. So you must keep that balance. On top of that, we must not confuse human honor with honor that we give to God. The honor that we give to God is called love. We like to love our fellow humans, and we can honor them. But it's better to give God love as opposed to honor, because you're using a human term. And we stay away from those human terms because we can get lost in the literal meaning of these things. So, that's my take.
Okay. Well, when we say I'm just trying to think of an example from, well, again, King David talks about the king of honor. There is a scene in the book of Genesis where Abraham actually went to war against four kings, and he led a battle with five kings with the inner intent of getting back his nephew Lot, who was kidnapped by one of the four kings. And he was actually offered a great amount of bounty from one of the kings of, I believe it was Sodom. And Rambam said that, I don't even want to take the shoelaces that have been taken from the spoil from the battle that we had just won, that he was more concerned, first of all, that the people who had fought with them, if they wanted to take that bounty, that they could take it. But Abraham responded that he wanted to be known publicly, that he did not want to take. He wanted to give thanks to the Most High, the fact that he had survived that battle and he had retrieved his nephew from the clutches of death. Because if they had held on to Lot, they probably would have ransomed him. If the ransom hadn't been paid, he might have been killed or tortured, whatever. So Rambam, in that way, since was giving honor to God and at the same time too expressing love to him, by not giving into the whims, although, and again, the king of Sodom was acting what you would consider to be in a socially appropriate way, to give spoil to the one who captured the spoil. But that spoil actually was spoil that was taken from his kingdom. So Abraham told him, or Avram at the time, because he wasn't called Abraham yet, Avram told him, you take it, you give to my soldiers who had gone with me, and I want to give glory to God. because they honor to God, expressing his love to God, that I am not taking from you, because Avram was not pleased yet still with the conduct of the king of Sodom. And unfortunately, eventually, we saw what would happen to Sodom and Gomorrah. And even though we do see as well that Abraham, or I should say Avram, he did pray that they should be spared. Unfortunately, they weren't. And I think it's in Ezekiel talks about what was the cardinal, if we could say this modern term, the cardinal sin of Sodom, is that they did not do enough charity for the poor, for the orphaned, and the orphan children, and for the women who are widowed. So
well, Don, there is no honor in dirty money, and greed is greed.
Right.
So therefore, it isn't the size of your bank account that gets credit for honor.
True. Abraham definitely understood that. But he was trying to send a message to the king of Sodom that you are not going to be, I'm not, he did not want to bequeath him that honor of further enriching Abraham. That the honor of the king of Sodom would have been if they would have changed the laws to be a more kind and merciful society. Unfortunately, they paid the price ultimately for not heeding to the prophet's call and to God's call ultimately. With that being said, I want to move on, Dennis, to compassion for humanity in the Jewish tradition. And we're taking again from Rabbi Nachman. And he wants to emphasize the attribute of peace. And he says the following: to the extent that there is peace in the world, mankind can be brought to serve God with one accord. Because of the peace that exists between people, they are able to enter into dialogue with one another and together think about the purpose of the world and its vanities. They can discuss the truth with one another, that ultimately nothing will remain of a person but the preparations he made for the eternal world. Quote, nothing accompanies a man, neither silver nor gold, nor precious gems nor pearls, but only the Torah, and I'm inserting now that he or she has learned, and their good deeds, which is a teaching from the Ethics of Our Fathers, chapter 6, verse 9. By realizing this, each person will cast away his false gods of silver and turn to the Creator, his Torah and divine service. He will bring himself to the truth. However, when there is no peace, God forbid, or worse, when there's actual strife, people cannot get together and discuss the ultimate purpose of life. Even when on occasion they do meet and talk to one another, if someone speaks the truth, his words are not heard due to the climate of jealousy, conflict, spite, and disdain. Aggression and the desire to win arguments cannot bear the truth. Thus, the main thing that keeps most people far from the Creator is strife, which has become widespread because of our many sins. May God have mercy upon us. Your comments or concerns about this teaching, Dennis?
Yeah, well, if humans aren't at peace, they can't face what is right and just, because what's disturbing them becomes of a higher or greater level of distraction on the priority list. So if there's no peace, there can't be truth, there can't be beauty, and there can't be love, because it's very hard to get to those things while people are concentrating on strife, war, and other problems that cause or the opposite of peace. So what happens is that we strive to, or some people actually try to convince themselves, after the strife of the war, we'll have peace. But that means they're willing to accept the problems in front of them now as strife or war. That means they're not practicing peace. So how can they be sane enough to say that after the war and the strife is over, then we'll have time to concentrate on peace? If you don't do it now, you're not going to have it in the future. You're just kidding yourself, because if you use the human reasoning to split hairs now, you're only going to do it again in the future.
Yes. Dennis, thank you for sharing with that. When I want to go into one more quote from this book, Passion of Humanity in the Jewish Tradition. Quoting from Psalms chapter 145, verse 9, quote, God is good for everything, and his mercies are upon all his works, end of quote. And this is again from Rabbi Nachman commenting, God is good for everything. So Rabbi Nachman asserts that this is alluding to prayer. A person who believes in God knows that he is, quote, good for everything, which implies healing, sustenance, or whatever one needs. Therefore, he will direct his efforts primarily towards the Almighty through prayer and not be taken up with various strategies. One who does not believe in the Most High, however, will pursue all sorts of mundane solutions to his problem. For example, if a person becomes sick, he will pursue all sorts of medical treatments. The herbs required may not be available locally, or the local varieties may be an inferior quality. However, God is good for everything. No matter what ailment one needs to be healed, God is always available. Now, I want to stop there for a moment before we read further, Dennis. Now, again, Rabbi Nachman is not necessarily telling people don't take medication, but I think what he's implying subtly, and I'd like to get your take on this, is prayer has a placebo effect on one's own medical treatment. I remember several years ago I attended a lecture by a psychiatrist, and he mentioned that the placebo effect in relation to psychotropic medications used to treat people with all different types of what we quote unquote mental illness have been shown clinically to have up to a 31% rate of success, meaning giving people sugar pills and telling a person this is for anxiety or this is for thought insertions or this is for paranoia. And people have taken those sugar pills and under clinical studies have been their symptoms have been relieved. But the psychiatrist then went on to assert, I just, in good faith, as a medical practitioner, I cannot prescribe all the time sugar pills for every person, of course, outside of a clinical setting, because the percentage of healing based on those clinical studies is not high enough. I have to go with the higher percentage of how to, and of course, psychotropic medication is not here to heal people, but rather to lower the intensity of the symptoms related to mental illness. So Dennis, before we go into the last paragraph of Rabbi Nachman's teaching about how God is good for everything and his mercies are upon all his works, what's your take upon this? Why people are not still connecting the dots between what they need and how their prayers can be connected to supplying them for what they need in life?
Well, you just mentioned, or you described the word placebo, which comes from the Greek, meaning it's a false sense. But then again, are you treating the physical or the human psyche? In a lot of cases, doctors realize that they're dealing with the human psyche with a lot of patients. So what they do is they will feed them an obvious thing that they prescribe. A sugar pill. You prescribe the sugar pill, and the person goes get the prescription filled, and they say, see, I'm on medicine. I'm feeling better already. Now, that's dealing with the psyche. That's not dealing with a real physical problem or a real mental problem. So, yes, a human doctor has to guess which one is he actually trying to fool or actuate. So, yes. Now, not all humans are convinced that everything is good for them. They believe that they can make these decisions. That's why we have the Bible, the Ten Commandments, to say, well, we have help for you to understand what is good or the best way of doing things. That's why there's laws and that's why there's rules and regulations, because we're advising you to heed these things and to understand. Now, if you don't trust God, how can you believe in the word good? Because now you're going to say, well, if I don't get a good return from it, I'm not going to get involved. Well, you just flush charity down the toilet because you don't think you're getting a good return. But the word good here is being misused. You're using that to abrogate the rules and regulations of what is a good and straight path you should be on. What is good for your mind, your body, and how you relate to God.
Beautiful, Dennis. Now we'll go into the last paragraph, and then we'll go take a snippet from the path of the Rosh Gentile. Excuse me. And Rabbi Nachman concludes in this section here, prayer leads to universal peace. Thus the verse concludes that we quoted before in Psalms 145, verse 9, quote, and his mercies are upon all his works, end of quote. Rabbi Nachman continues, when people turn to God, the Creator, as the ultimate power, divine mercy will be drawn forth to all creatures. Consequently, all creatures will have mercy upon one another, and there will be peace among them. As is written, quote, and the wolf shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the kid, and they shall not harm or destroy. That's from Isaiah chapter 11, verses 6 and 9. For there will be peace between them. Thus, his mercies are upon all his works. In other words, God will instill mercy in the hearts of all creatures, and they will treat each other accordingly. As our sages have taught, quote, whoever shows mercies to God's creatures is granted mercy from heaven. This is from the Talmudic Tractate of Shabbos, page 151, side B. And this is borne out by the scriptural verse, quote, and God will give you mercy. He will have mercy upon you. And that's in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 13, verse 18. Dennis, this is one of, you know, this is my heartfelt desire in my life, as much as I can accomplish on a very microscopic level, to encourage people to realize we are configured, our hardwired configuration with the Most High is that we can elicit his mercies if we can just see that his mercies are upon all his works, all of his creatures. And if we connect to the Most High with that perception, you don't have to be a guru, you don't have to be a rabbi, you don't have to be a priest, you don't have to be a preacher, reverend, you just have to be a human being that believes that God is the source of all mercies. Dennis, how can we get this message out more and more to people? You don't have to be, you just have to be you. That's special enough to access these mercies, to bring, to help other people experience his mercies by the fact you acknowledge that he's the source of mercy for everyone.
That's
true,
but you cannot have peace unless you have trust. Trust is the relationship between entities. You must have trust in God. You must have trust in your fellow man. If you do, then you can start practicing what is peace and doing good deeds that will build on something. But if you don't establish the trust, then you're using sand for a foundation.
True. Yeah, listen, this is sober reality.
How can we activate trust? Well, you tell people, try it. You might like it. It's not that bad. Not going to hurt you. And in the long run, you'll feel better, believe it or not. There's no guarantees, but you're foolish if you don't try it.
Okay, we're going to go now to, quickly, we're going to go to the path of the Gentile, kind of moving into repentance mode. I don't think we covered it last week. If we did, we'll repeat the teaching, and we'll make a footnote so we can go on with the next teaching. This is in chapter 8, Returning to God. So what is considered to be repentance, or as we like to call it tshuva in Hebrew, returning to the Creator? It is when the person who has sinned has abandoned his or her sin, removing it from his or her thoughts, and has made a resolution not to do it again. Consequently, he or she now regrets what has happened in the past and accepts God as to be the knower of secrets, as his witness that he will never return to such a sin again. And he needs to confess verbally and state the resolutions that he made in his heart. Now, he's very careful here, the rabbis Rogalski and Glorfin are very careful to note that if we're talking about transgressions between man and God, these are things that a person should confess solely within their heart. They can use speech as well, but it's a personal type of confession. It's not something that need be brought out to another human being for acceptance or confirmation or absolution or any type. It's basically, it is a wireless connection that you don't need a cell phone for. It's something basically a person is just being, I think we talked about this last week as well, Dennis, that the idea a person has to become comfortable getting to know themselves, conversing with themselves, conversing with the Creator, and coming to this point saying, I want to make a change in my life. So any comments or concerns about this type of teaching?
Yes, this has been knocked around for many millennium, Don. It's an old subject that we wonder if it really has a human resolution to it. Why? Because some people say, well, unless you humble yourself in front of another human, we don't really believe that you're willing to believe in the words you say or that you're not going to do it again. Other people say, well, you don't have to go that far. If you do it in your head and you pray to God, well, that would be the same thing. Now, on a human scale, we don't know because no one has been over to the other side of life in a heavenly environment to tell us, does this work or this doesn't? So humans are in a conflict here because we don't know if we can chastise ourselves. Do we need other people? Do we need to prostrate ourselves in front of God? Some people believed in, this is a history now, going way back when, that you have to flagellate yourself to a certain extent. You have to wear a very rough material for a shirt to remind you that you sin from time to time. Now, the other part of the human dilemma is, when we commit sins, small or big, we tend to be habitual about it. It's very hard to break our habits. Very, very hard. You have to work at it. I mean, little kids growing up would do different things that the parents didn't like, and they would swat you in the head and say, don't do that anymore. Well, that's okay. How many swats in the head did you finally get that you realized maybe you shouldn't be doing this? And you'll save bumps and bruises to your head. But when you get older, there's no one around to swat you around. Now, can you take care of yourself? This is an old, age-old question. And how can you measure yourself? You do it by introspection and comparison to a certain extent. But you must have enough faith and belief in what you're doing and that God is watching over you. Now, the other part of the God that you just mentioned before is that God is always with us. He's hoping that we will get on the right track. He's not going to push us to get on the right track because we all have freedom to think and our own thoughts. We can make the decisions. So he's waiting for us to return to him by getting back on the track. He's waiting. He's patient. He can wait your lifetime because he's going to be there for all time. So if you don't recognize that he's there waiting for you, then you're going to feel very lonely.
Beautiful, Dennis. We're now ready to come down to the last portion, last but not least portion of our show. And we're going into the book of Genesis, verse 8, and then Genesis, verse 9. And I personally, when I look at these verses now, and this, you know, in the middle, or actually at the end of the winter, coming into the spring, where springtime is a time of renewal, perhaps we have to renew our perceptions of these verses, because I think some people just run over these verses, you know, to get to the point where, you know, there was that sin and the snake and everything, and, you know, and then there was Cain and Abel, but you have to slow down a little bit and maybe do a little analysis, and we can be empowered by these teachings in the oral Torah traditions. What's going on here, and why is Don Goodman talking about a tension between one verse and another verse? Well, again, we go to chapter 2, verse 8. We see God planted a garden in Eden to the east, and there he placed the man that he had formed. Hey, it's all wonderful. And we talked about last week that the word Eden or Eden is a place of delight. And I saw also I don't know if I brought it out so clearly, but I'll bring it out here from the Torah anthology. The implications that God did not bring trees from elsewhere and planted them here, but rather that the entire earth give forth plants and trees, but this a specific place would be, quote unquote, a perfect garden, as only God can truly understand what a perfect garden is. And he expected that a certain type of tree should grow in this place, and that where trees and plants grow upon the earth should not grow. The place called the Garden of Eden should be arranged in a certain specific order, where in other places, so to speak, according to human perception, trees and plants can grow haphazardly. And there in that place, the trees in the garden will have foliage and be filled with fruit, and these trees will never grow old and know they require any attention like ordinary trees. Okay, fine. Everything looks good. Just like the first verse in the Torah says, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Now, all of a sudden we have the next verse. Out of the ground, God made grow every tree that is pleasant to look at and good to eat. Hey, sounds pretty good. We have the tree of life in the middle of the garden, and we have the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Well, to me, Dennis, and anyone listening out there, flags, yellow flags, red flags are flying up all over the place. Because the knowledge of good and evil? Well, the Torah anthology talks about this idea that the tree of life was very large, having deep roots, and a thick trunk with much foliage. And the second tree was called the tree of knowledge, since it was sharpened, since it was created to sharpen the intellect and make one's eyesight more acute. It also had a very delicious taste. So this verse seems to indicate that both trees were in the precise center of this garden called the Garden of Eden. And the Torah anthology teacher said that there are a number of ways which this can be explained. One possibility is that both trees had a single trunk that was in the precise center of the garden. He then divided into two trees, each with different characteristics. And then others say, and this is from the Kabbalistic knowledge from the Zohar, that only the tree of life was in the exact center of the garden. It was surrounded by the tree of knowledge, and the branches and fruit of the tree of knowledge covered the tree of life, so the two appeared as one tree. Now, this is where there can be a little tension. What is life, that a tree should be called the tree of life? And what is a tree that its knowledge and being attributed the attributes of sharpening the intellect and strengthening the eyesight, which is certainly a positive thing, but yet it's a knowledge of good, which we have no problem with, but then there's the knowledge of evil, which a person can be tempted by that evil. Now, Dennis, I'm going to ask you to we have about 9 minutes to go, give me some feedback on how you look at these verses.
All right. Well,
and, go ahead.
Well, to me, there is no tension, except if you take verses 8 and 9 literally, because it's not an agriculture digest here. It is not explaining how you plant things in a garden and how you get things to grow. What it's doing is telling you that in 8 you have the word Lord God and capitalized he twice there. So it's saying that God started a place in Eden, a good place, a happy place, because there was no strife. There was peace there. There was nothing to cause problems. And what did he do? He put his best creation called man in that area. So now, he said, the ground, if you go into verse 9, the ground is going to let things grow, except it mentions two trees that don't exist in biological worlds, because the tree is really the man that was put in the garden in the first place in verse 8. And 9, now we have, if you read it a little differently, without reading it literally, it's a good place, for the site because humans are sentient people and they are hungry. Yes, you can get food, but they have a chance for life and knowledge. And part of that life is where they're going to gain age, procreate, multiply, and they're going to be able to know the difference between good and evil. So if you read it literally, you're in trouble because you're asked to believe concepts that just don't fit in on a very technical scale. So this is a concept upon concepts of how God started everything in a garden where he wanted humans to grow and grow and grow, grow in life, grow in knowledge.
Well, then, I'm here at this point. I have to disagree respectfully because the Torah of Moshe was given as a literal instruction. And there was, in fact, there is a Garden of Eden. We just don't know where it is. And the fact that we see that the Torah in Genesis talks about the fact that Adam and Eve ate from a physical tree, not an allegorical tree. The tension that I'm trying to bring out here, extract out, is the tension that the human experience has between distinguishing what is the source of life and what is the source of knowledge of good and evil. And in fact, there is a teaching from the 5th Lubavitcher Rebbe that mentioned that the lacking of service in those initial moments in the life of Adam and Eve, and primarily of Adam, was that he ate from the tree of knowledge before the tree of life, because the tree of life is alluding to, ultimately, although it was a physical tree, alluding to the idea that there is only the true knowledge is the knowledge of God. But, and at the same time, too, that God gave us practical knowledge of what to do and what not to do. So when human beings start to decide there is what to do and what not to do, to the exclusion of the acknowledgement of that God is the source of life, that's where we can start to create with our own minds and our living experience what is good and what is evil, and therefore that becomes the source of conflict, as opposed to the Most High has embedded within every molecule of the creation what is good, which is he is the good, and that those things which we should abstain from, just as a person should abstain from taking in certain types of foods which are not cooked, you know, properly. So that's the type of tension that I'm alluding to, is that the human condition first must acknowledge God is the tree of life, the ultimate source. So he's not the tree of life, but the source of the tree of life, meaning he is our source of life, and therefore he is our source of knowledge, which we are humbly trying to share with the human community, the human family, that this God who is the source of life gave us a tree. But unless we are not fully, you know, taken up by the idea, the perception that he is our life, he is our source of our life, then when we come to make decisions, what's good and evil, to the exclusion of that he, if we cannot acknowledge that he is the one who tells us what is good and what is evil, then we're going to start to have conflicts, and the tension will arise. For instance, God asked Cain after he murdered Abel, "Where's your brother?" So Cain said, "Am I my brother's keeper?" I mean, it was quite obvious that he was a brother who's supposed to keep a brother alive. So this is the tension that I am trying to point to, not necessarily something that is.
Then you're saying the tension is in the interpretation, not in the words.
The tension is that if man cannot see, if the tension arises that if man cannot see that knowledge of right and wrong is ultimately connected with the one who is the source of all life, then we're going to come into tension between our knowledge of God and separate from him being the source of what is good and of what should be defined as good and evil.
If man can't accept God as being the source, then all is lost, Don.
Well, we see in civilizations where, you know, people interacted with very highly conscious people that didn't take their advice to change their ways, ultimately, they again, like saying Sodom and Gomorrah, Sodom and Gomorrah, you say in Hebrew, whatever, that they, on the simplest level, they stopped doing charity, and they lost the mercies of the Creator and all of His works, including that those five municipalities, which you can go to the south of Israel and see, you know, the desolation that still exists there today, and that Dead Sea, which is not a place of life. Anyway, Dennis, we're now down to the last 2 minutes of the show. I want to thank you very much. We'll continue, hopefully, on these concepts and more in the next week's show. I want to now conclude the show with Lighten Up by David Dohm. And David Dohm, of course, is our good friend from England, who helps us bring us back home to that place that we all need to be more aware of, and myself more than anyone, before anyone else, our divine image, which will help us scrimmage into the creation in a positive way, the Tzelem Elokim, which is not a dream. Take care, everyone. And for those that will be celebrating Purim and those who are not, have a wonderful week of joy and happiness and transformation of negativity into positivity. Take care, everyone.
Laila Tov.